I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome back to Radio Times. What causes someone to commit a violent act? There's been a long-standing debate about the role and influence of nature and nurture. Is it because of someone's genetic makeup, their upbringing, their environment, or some combination of these factors? Our guest, neurocriminologist Adrian Raine, has been studying the biological origins of crime and antisocial behavior for several decades. He uses imaging technology to see if there are anomalies in the brains of murderers and psychopaths that would explain their violent tendencies. His new book, The Anatomy of Violence, is about his work and some of the ethical issues it raises. For instance, if you could identify someone who is at risk for violent behavior, would you intervene? Our guest, Adrian Raine, is the Richard Perry University Professor in the Departments of Criminology, Psychiatry, and Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. And Adrian Raine, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty.
Good morning to you. Let's go back, I guess, early on in your career. You worked for 4 years as a psychologist in a prison back in England where you studied.
That's right.
What was your interest in I guess, criminals?
Well, I think all of us are interested in crime, what they do, what causes it. It's just one of those fascinating universals, I think, that really intrigue all of us. I think for me, I was interested in, is it more than poverty? Is it more than bad neighborhoods? Is it more than racial discrimination? And, you know, of course, all of those things are important. And in my book, I'm not saying they're not important. But what I'm trying to do is use new neuroscience techniques to dig down underneath the surface, to dig up the root causes of crime that, you know, we've not seen before. So, yeah, you can see, poor neighborhoods. You might even witness child abuse. But you can't see my genes. You can't see what's going on inside my head. Now we can. We can now, for the first time, literally look inside the minds of murderers.
I was reading some reporting of some of the early work that you did where you were, it sounds like, locked in vans with
yes.
with murderers. That seems like a risky way to begin one's career.
That was scary. You know, I this is going back to 1980, and I was working for 4 years in top security prisons in England as a psychologist. Right. But I also wanted to study the brains of the people I was interviewing. So I got a Ford Transit van and had it rigged up to have physiology equipment inside it. So I would drive the van in the prison in the morning into a secure area, and then a prisoner would be brought to me and he'd be put into the van and locked inside with me while I tested him. Now the three prison officers and the two guard dogs around the van, they would take the keys and lock me inside. And you know, I was really scared the day I tested a hostage taker, a man known for taking hostages. I thought, my God, you know, what could happen here? You know, is science really that important? What about your life? So it was a bit terrifying at times, but it was also fun and exciting. And, you know, for me, it's a bit of stimulation in life. It's doing something new and different. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, but I'm interested even the sort of then and now of imaging. I mean, what you could look at then in this van parked in the middle of a maximum security prison, and what you can look at today.
It's all changed, and that's the exciting thing about the developments in science and neuroscience, you know, the new brain imaging techniques. Yeah, I didn't have them in my day in the prison. I was using EEG, the electroencephalogram. You put electrodes on your head, you're looking at the electrical activity of the brain. But now we can pop people into brain scanners and look at the physical structure of the brain. I mean, are some people physically different to the rest of us? And those physical differences could cause people to become violent.
Well, in fact, what you have found from some of this imaging is looking at a very specific subset of people. These are murderers or psychopaths, mm-hmm. that their prefrontal cortex looks different.
It's true. So, you know, we took 41 murderers, we put them into a functional brain scanner, we compared them with 41 normal people, And our key finding there was that the murderers have much poorer functioning in the very frontal region of the brain. You know, the part that sits right above your eyes, it lies behind your forehead. It's just not functioning well in murderers.
And what does that mean? It doesn't light up? It doesn't respond?
Exactly. It doesn't light up as much. I mean, there is something there, but it's just not as activated, as functioning as in normal people. Now, the important question is, what does this do normally? Normally, your frontal cortex is involved in controlling and regulating your behavior. You know, when you have an impulse to do something, the prefrontal cortex says, no, not right now, not at this moment. It's also the part that regulates emotions. I mean, come on, we've all been angry at times. We've always wanted to, you know, whack someone. You know, what stops us? It's the prefrontal cortex. It's the guardian angel on our behavior. And if the guardian angel is asleep, then the devil could come out and somebody could kill.
But would it be fair to say that, and you're looking at a small group of people, mm-hmm. we're talking about 41, murderers?
Exactly.
And 41 so-called normal people. Mm. It seems to me that the difficulty, of course, is extrapolating from that to the entire population. I mean, can you say that if you have prefrontal cortex anomalies, mm-hmm. that would increase your risk for antisocial behavior?
You're quite right. There's an important caveat here. It's not one size fits all. So, you know, like, not all murderers are the same. We had one murderer who killed 64 people in a 12-year period without being caught. Now, what was his frontal cortex like? Like, you know, it lit up like a Christmas tree. It was well activated. He's called Randy Kraft. You know, what's going on here?
Right.
Well, here we have a man who could carefully plan and regulate his behavior, execute these people, clean up the mess afterwards, and then go into work. He was a computer consultant the next morning. You have to have something good going for you to do that. And he had a good frontal cortex allowing him to plan and regulate and stay in control of his victims.
Are we talking about a psychopath here? I mean, someone who... Yes. Just doesn't have the kind of emotional capacity to care about other people.
That's right. And indeed, when we turn to looking at psychopaths, because we've also brain scanned psychopaths, one of the more interesting findings we find there is there's a part of the brain deep inside called the amygdala. It's the seat of emotions. It's what generates normal emotions like, you know, conscience, remorse, guilt, empathy. The things that psychopaths don't have. Mm-hmm. So when we scanned them, Marty, we found that the amygdala is shrunken in size by 18% in these heartless, cold-blooded psychopaths. And that could give us a clue to why they just don't have the feelings of remorse and shame that we do.
Well, and this is something you can't do, but it would be interesting to get brain scans of the entire population of this country, more than 300 million people, in order to see just how much, I guess, of cause and effect some of these anomalies are.
You're so right here. You know, the cause-effect issue is critical, so let me explain that a bit. We've got an adult psychopath, an adult murderer, and we find that the brain functioning or brain structure isn't quite the same as the rest of us. But it's the chicken and egg question. Right. So is the brain impairment causing the violence, or is it living a violent way of life sort of damages your brain because you get involved in fights? One thing we've done, though, is we took 1,800 three-year-old children. And we
in Mauritius, right?
Yeah, in Mauritius, where I do a lot of my research. It's a small tropical island in the Indian Ocean. Terrible place to go and do research. I should be over in Detroit doing it. But it's a lovely tropical island. Great fun to go there. And so we measured amygdala functioning in 1,800 three-year-old children. It's an indirect measure, a biological measure of this emotion center. And what we found, we followed up the children for 20 years till they were age 23. Some of them had criminal convictions. And when we compared the criminal offenders at 23 with those who weren't criminal, if we go back in time 20 years ago, we found that the criminals had poor fear. They had a lack of fear. This is a measure of, it's called fear conditioning. It's what the amygdala is critically involved in. So we're showing here that, you know, something as early as age three is not perfectly predicting to crime, but gives us some predictive power in explaining and predicting to future offending.
But I'm wondering, taking those findings then and maybe even digging into the nurture side, whether you find dysfunctional families, or whether you find perhaps accidents or injuries that might explain some of these differences.
No, I think this is important, yes, because we found this impairment as early as age three. So that's suggesting that maybe it's really coming on early in life. Maybe it's genetic, neurodevelopmental. But you're quite right. The environment also affects the brain. It's critical. You know, let's take physical child abuse. If a kid's battered around, including his head, that will damage that very frontal region of the brain. There's other early risk factors, like, for example, if a pregnant mum smokes cigarettes during pregnancy, her offspring are 2 to 3 times more likely to become violent criminal offenders 20 years later. If she drinks, you get the same thing. In fact, you can ask, how much would a pregnant mother need to drink per week to raise aggression in her child by 30%? Would it be 30 drinks a week? Would it be 20? Would it be 10? Would it be 5? One drink a week will do it. So it's a dose-response relationship. The more of these toxins the fetus is exposed to that damages the brain, the more likely that they will become a violent offender.
What about things like nutrition, for instance?
Nutrition, again, is critically important. So, for example, you know, not our work, but fascinating research of over 1 million pregnant mothers showing if the mothers had poor nutrition during pregnancy, the offspring are 3 times more likely in adulthood to develop what's called antisocial personality disorder, meaning lifelong criminal offending. In our work, we've shown that 3-year-old children with poor nutrition, they are more aggressive and antisocial at ages 8, ages 11, ages 17. It just goes on because poor nutrition impairs the brain.
Well, and I would also think poor nutrition is a sign of probably poverty, of difficult family lives, of perhaps difficult neighborhoods as well, that also might be a factor.
Well, absolutely. And just a methodological note here, when I was saying that poor nutrition at age three raises the odds of aggression later on, that's after you control for 11 social risk factors like, low income, low education of the parents, poor neighborhood, large family size. So it goes above and beyond the social factors, but not to say that the social factors are not important. They are, clearly. But it's like, you know, there's like two sides of a coin. For the past 100 years, we've focused on the social side of the coin. In the anatomy of violence, what I'm doing is turning the coin round and showing this is what's on the other side, the biological parts.
We're almost up on a break here, but are you saying not that it's cause and effect, but we have more and more research that at least raises questions about this balance between nature and nurture?
It's definitely raising questions, and there's more and more early research. It's called longitudinal research that takes the measures early on in life, follows up the kids, and is suggestive of causality. You can never prove it for certain, but it's suggestive.
And that's Adrienne Raine, our guest today on Radio Times. The book is called The Anatomy of Violence, and it's subtitled The Biological Roots of Crime. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. He's the Richard Perry University Professor in the Departments of Criminology, Psychiatry, and Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Coastal Spine in South Jersey supports WHYY, providing physical therapy, spinal injections, EMGs, and minimally invasive surgery options for neck and back pain. CoastalSpine.com or 856-222-4444.
Thanks to more than 5,000 of you who made a pledge of support during our Spring FM campaign, I'm Mike and Scott. At a time when high-quality news and information is critical, you turn to WHYY to meet your wants and needs. And we are committed to investing your dollars into the kind of service you expect from us. Learn more about membership and how to become a sustaining auto-renew member at WHYY.org. And if you've already pledged, thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Jim DeRogatis.
And I'm Greg Kot. Sound Opinions is the world's only rock and roll talk show.
And as hosts and critics, we get a chance to debate our favorite bands, but everybody's a critic, so we like to give our listeners the last word.
Guys, That was painful.
And yeah, Jim and Greg, I agreed with you guys.
They are horrible.
It's not a complaint. It's a thank you.
Thanks for the in-depth story there.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY. Supporting WHYY, North Highland, a global management consulting company that's been working with Fortune 500 companies for over 20 years. Details about how they start every client relationship by asking their clients to speak first at northhighland.com/you first.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with neurocriminologist Adrian Raine. He's been studying the biological origins of crime for about 30 years now, and through advances in imaging technology has appeared into the minds of psychopaths and seen anomalies in their brain structure. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I'm wondering about, I realize we're talking about a very small subset here, but I was thinking about people that do engage in spousal abuse or child abuse. There are so many different kinds of, I guess, criminals and violent kinds of behavior, whether you think they're same kind of abnormalities you would see in their brains as well. Do we know that?
We do to some extent. So, for example, I've been brain scanning spouse abusers, you know, men who beat up their wives. And you're quite right. We find something different there. Remember the emotion part of the brain, the amygdala. In them, it's not functioning more poorly. It's over-responding. So partly what the amygdala does is, you know, if you upset me, if you begin to criticize my book and things like that, I might begin to get a little bit emotional. The amygdala, the emotion engine, is firing up here and making me a little bit angry. And we find that if we present spouse abusers with mildly provocative emotional stimuli, maybe like the type that they experience in the home, right, the amygdala is far more activated than we get in the normal person. And also their frontal cortex, the regulation part, isn't functioning as much. So it's a bit like, you know, with a mild irritation, they over-respond emotionally from their brain, and they don't have the prefrontal resources to be able to keep in check their angry feelings. So yes, violence is heterogeneous. I mean, there's many different forms and types, and we're just beginning to learn about specific subgroups which differ in terms of their brain function.
And it's interesting that we use language like, you know, a cold-hearted killer or crimes of passion. I mean, these are not scientific terms, but perhaps speaking to some of the internal mechanisms.
Exactly. You know, one of the best replicated correlates or biological correlates of aggressive violent behavior is a low resting heart rate. Studies all over the world find the same thing, that, you know, if you measure low resting heart rate in a mildly stressful situation, you know, those with the low resting heart rate relative to people who, you know, respond to a stressor, those low resting heart rate people are much more likely to be violent, antisocial, criminal. What's going on here? The low heart rate during a stressor is measuring a lack of fear, a lack of stress reactivity. And, you know, if you lack fear, you're more likely to do things that, you know, may get punished because you're not concerned, you're not frightened about the potential punishment. I don't know if you remember Ted Kaczynski.
I was just going to say Ted Kaczynski.
The Unabomber. I mean, he was a fearless man sitting there in his camping making these bombs. He could have blown up in a second. He was a very fearless man. And his resting heart rate was 54 beats a minute, really low.
Well, and this is where it gets complicated, because you also include your own heart rate in this book, which is even lower than Ted Kaczynski's. Well, you're 48 beats a minute. So what does that tell us?
Well, yeah, well, this is, well, okay, I think what it tells us is that there are supposedly normal people like myself with the biological risk factors. So, I mean, in addition to that, when we brain scanned my brain, it looked very much like that of the serial killer who killed 64 people. Yeah,
really?
I mean, compare it to the serial
killers.
Your
amygdala, your prefrontal cortex.
Prefrontal and the thalamus. Compare it to a normal, a one-off killer, a serial killer. It's a dead ringer for the serial killers. I had poor nutrition as a kid. Angular stomatitis, cracking of the mouth and lips. That's riboflavin deficiency. So, I mean, what's always fascinated me is, you know, when I was in prison there interviewing the prisoner, I always thought it could have been just the other way around. What made the difference? And, you know, we haven't done great research yet on these protective factors. But just as an individual, you know, for me, I had parents that loved me. And I always had a roof over my head. There was always a meal on the table. You know, maybe the Beatles were right. All you need is love, you know, and maybe love can really protect you. And in fact, I go into a case study, not me, another case study in The Anatomy of Violence, which illustrates that.
Well, and I don't know much about you, but I was reading a little bit that as a young kid, 9, 10, 11 years old, you were a fire setter. I mean, it sounds like you were a kid either in trouble or certainly a troubled kid.
Yes. And, you know, what I didn't put in the book, I had to be taken to hospital at age 5 to have my stomach pumped because I drank so much alcohol. That was at age 5. So
had you just mistakenly gotten into the liquor cabinet?
Well, you know, it was a Christmas. My brother had been born and there was a lot of alcohol swishing around. So, yeah, I broke into the cocktail cabinet with I drank 3/4 of a bottle of Harvey's Bristol Cream. And so, yes, and I, you know, and by the way, maybe all of us have a rough period in life. You know, yes. So mine was from age 9 to 11. I broke out of it. And then again, it raises the fascinating question, what are the social dynamics that can make a difference? For me, it was, I think, as simple as changing schools, changing my peer group. So, you know what? Peer groups are important. And, you know, later in life, I've had relatively good peers. You know, university professors don't go around killing too many people.
No.
They can be critical. But maybe the social environment is also critical here. Let's not forget the importance of social influences also.
Well, as you said, that you had loving parents, and of course that can go a long way in many factors in life. But I also wonder whether it tells something about not just the plasticity of the brain, but we know that the brain has plasticity, but just the importance of some of these other factors that can mitigate perhaps some of these built-in biological tendencies.
Yes, you know, certainly if you go in the opposite direction, neglect certainly impairs the brain. So reverse thrust on that and enrich the environment. Enrich the environment. Can that change the brain to change behavior? We think so. We did a study where we enriched the environments of 3-year-old children by giving them better nutrition, more physical exercise, a cognitive stimulation. We did it for 2 years. There was a control group. At age 11, 8 years later, we measured brain functioning and they had better brain functioning. Their brains were 1 year more mature. We followed them up to age 23 and the kids who went into the early enrichment showed a 34% reduction in criminal offending 20 years later. So we can do things to change the brain early on to change later behavior.
Well, in fact, it seems like fish oil, I mean, to be very specific here, fish oil has played an important role in some of the research you've done with some of the findings that you've had.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, one that I report there in The Anatomy of Violence is, you know, giving fish oil to kids aged 6 to 16 for 6 months. Now, one group gets the drink containing the omega-3, and the other get the fruit drink, which doesn't have the omega-3. Well, after 6 months, the antisocial aggressive behavior of both groups go down. It's called a placebo effect. But if you follow them up 6 months after treatment ends, the control group go back to where they came from. They're just as antisocial as they used to be. Whereas the kids in the omega-3 group, they continue to go down in their aggressive antisocial behavior six months after
treatment. What is it about omega?
Omega-3 is a long-chain fatty acid, which is very critical for brain structure and function. It makes up 35% of the cell membrane. It enhances the connectivity of the neuron. It enhances the life of the neuron. It regulates gene expression. It regulates neurotransmitter functioning. And our bodies can't produce that. It can only come from outside, from our food.
And Adrian Raine is our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about his new book called The Anatomy of Violence, subtitled The Biological Roots of Crime. He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me just go back and pick up on a couple of things that you said earlier, then I'll get some callers in on the conversation. I'm thinking about this low resting heart rate. In many ways, if I wanted to have surgery, I kind of would hope my surgeon would have a low resting heart rate. You talk about bomb diffusers having
nerves
low
of
resting.
Steel, yes, that's right.
That it can go either way.
It can be adaptive. You're quite right, because we also know that bomb disposal experts in the Army have low resting heart rates relative to the soldier controls. Now, let's face it, these are very fearless individuals. But instead of taking a life, they're saving lives. So the fascinating question is, you can have two people, both with this biological risk for a fearless, stimulation-seeking and antisocial lifestyle, and they have two very different outcomes. Mm. We don't know yet why, but my suspicion is it's the social environment that makes the difference.
Also, looking at some of these prefrontal cortex issues for criminals, I scribbled down Bernie Madoff. I mean, wouldn't it be interesting to look at white collar criminals, whether they have some of these same characteristics?
With my colleague Bill Laufer at the Wharton School, we did the first brain imaging study on white collar criminals, and actually we found something very different in them. We actually found brain enhancements in the white collar criminals compared to the control group. So parts of the brain involved in executive functions. What's that? That's like what an executive does in business: planning, regulation, thinking ahead, having the smarts to push the envelope, you know, on trades, for example. Those, and the part of the brain that is very responsive to abstract rewards. What's an abstract reward? Yeah. Money.
Right. Praise.
That part of the brain was actually thicker, physically thicker in the white collar offenders. So quite the opposite. They have attentional and cognitive brain enhancements that maybe give them an edge up amongst the rest of us in perpetrating white-collar crimes and not getting caught.
But do you think there are psychopathic tendencies in there in the sense of either entitlement or I just don't care?
Yes, exactly. I think that, we haven't done this. We're doing some more research on cheating behavior in actually undergraduate students. They're sort of a little bit, they're like the forerunner of white-collar offending. And again, we're looking at their physiological responsivity to moral dilemmas. We pose them a moral dilemma, measuring their heart rate and sweat rates. Are they more cold-blooded? Hmm. Are they do they cheat more and push the edge on academia more because they are sort of built that way?
We were talking about the effect of drinking, I guess, on fetal development, and you said even one drink could have an effect. And I'm imagining, a woman listening to the show that didn't know she was pregnant, had a drink, and now is thinking, oh my gosh, what have I done to this baby?
But not to worry, because, you can stop. And again, actually, what would a pregnant mother do? There is research showing that mothers, this is a very large-scale study from England, thousands and thousands of pregnant mothers, not my research, Joe Hiblin, who's at the National Institute of Alcoholism. What he found is that mothers who ate more fish during pregnancy, their offspring were more sociable and less antisocial and aggressive at age 7 to 8 years. So, if I was a pregnant mum, which I'm not, but if I was, I might think about omega-3. I mean, it really can't do a lot of harm.
So we're back to the fish oil.
Sounds fishy, doesn't it? But, there's lots of other things we can talk about. Like, there's new, research showing that mindfulness training or meditation enhances the very frontal part of the brain. It brings online the amygdala, that emotion part of the brain that we find to be functioning more poorly in psychopaths. Definitely good research on that, showing it affects the brain. What we haven't had yet is good research trying this out on prisoners. One study of 1,300 prisoners gave mindfulness training to them, claiming that it did reduce aggressive behavior, but we need the gold standard. We need a randomized controlled trial to see if this can change the brains in offenders and reduce recidivism later.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. We have Lynn from Bethlehem joining us. And Lynn, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you. Actually, I think the doctor just answered my question about if the brain can be rehabilitated through cognitive therapy or eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, or like you mentioned, the meditation. Have you made studies that shows a before brain and then an after brain,
it's
after the therapy?
Sure. Thanks, Lynn.
You know, that's a great question. You know, that work hasn't been done yet. You know, that's going to be the next generation of research. Really, because we're scratching the surface here. This is like beginning research, trying to give like healthy medicine, like nutrition, to improve brain, to improve behavior. At the moment, we're just doing the experimental work, manipulating nutrition and diets, and looking to see, does it change behavior? But gosh, your question is so good, because what you're asking is, if it works, how does it work and why? What part of the brain is coming online to improve behavior? That will be the next generation of research, I think.
Lynn, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I'm wondering, too, even when you're looking at large groups of people and you have some findings or you find some risk factors, that doesn't tell you about an individual, does it? And that's the struggle with this kind of research.
This is a big struggle, you know. It's a bit like child abuse. We know child abuse, you know, raises the odds that somebody will become violent. But most people who are abused never become antisocial. Most poor people don't become criminal. They do a wonderful job, you know, in poor circumstances. So, you know, it's very hard to, you know, take a specific individual and say, you know, where are they? Are they on the, what side of the bars are they? The criminal side or the socialized side?
Because I think what's potentially troubling is how eugenics has been used in the past, where based on probably very flimsy science, we have these conclusions about certain groups of people and how they're going to behave. And we had policy here in the United States dealing with that. Are we at the point now in the research where we can be more definitive or we can avoid the problems of eugenics?
I would hope that by open discussion of the type we're having now, we can avoid those negative sides that we've seen in the past, the misuse of biological research. And that's why I wanted to talk about it openly in the Anatomy of Violence. I think we can move forward. For example, right now, we make daily decisions on probation and parole based on just social and behavioral factors. New research is coming out now from Dustin Pardini, Ken Keel, two brand new brain imaging studies showing that if you brain scan offenders and follow them up for 3 years, the brain data helps us predict even better who is going to offend over and above the usual social and behavioral risk factors. So I think in the future, you know, in the not too distant future, we could bring on board these biological factors to improve prediction.
But again, you're back to the you know, 100 people versus one person.
Yeah.
I mean, by putting someone's by scanning someone's brain, could you imagine a time where you could say, well, this person, because of the way their amygdala looks, is going to re-offend?
Never. We'll never have perfect prediction. Here's the problem. Right now, we have to make these decisions right now. We do decide, and they are imperfect. So my argument is, bring in, you know, advances in statistical techniques, bring in the biology, and we can only get better in making the day-to-day predictions we have to make. There's error in the predictions right now, and so I'm interested in, can we improve it?
Well, and we're almost having a break here, and I guess by improving it, we need better technology, right? We need more. We can need to see even more parts of the brain.
Yes, indeed. And you know, the brain is part of it. There's also this autonomic nervous system, sweat rate, heart rate, and other biological indicators like hormone levels, like testosterone, for example. There are many different biological factors we've not even talked about yet.
Well, I'd like to talk about testosterone after this very short break, because I'm interested in some of the male-female differences when it comes to violence and antisocial behavior. And if you're just joining us, Adrian Raine is our guest today on the show. His book is called The Anatomy of Violence, and it's subtitled The Biological Roots of Crime. He's a professor of criminology at the University of Pennsylvania, and we have just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Questions or comments, give us a call. We'll be right back.
The Garden State Wine Growers Association supports WHYY and presents its annual Mother's Day Wine Trail Weekend, May 11th and 12th. In celebration of Mother's Day, the trail features wine tastings and special treats for mom from noon to 5 p.m. at participating wineries. From the Skylands in northern Sussex County to the tip of Cape May, there are six different trails showcasing wines from more than 40 wineries throughout New Jersey. The annual Mother's Day Wine Trail Weekend. Full details at NewJerseyWineTrails.com.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. This is Mrs. Jameson, the history teacher, and I just wanted to say goodbye.
On the next Fresh Air, Laura Linney talks about her starring role as a high school teacher who is battling cancer in Showtime's dark comedy, The Big C, which is now in its final season. Laura Linney on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY. There's been a lot of discussion about the new book Lean In by Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg. It's part memoir, part self-help book with posits about women and leadership. On the next Voices in the Family with Dr. Dan Gottlieb, our own posits about how women lead, what leadership is, and what drives women or holds them back. Today at noon, here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Adrian Rain. He's the Richard Perry University Professor in the Departments of Criminology, Psychiatry, and Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, author of this new book called The Anatomy of Violence. Just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Right before the break, you mentioned testosterone.
Yes.
Why does it, at least on the surface, appear to be that men are have greater risk for violence than women?
Part of the answer, of course not the total answer, is that they have obviously higher levels of testosterone than women. How do we know that it links to crime? Well, people have done studies of just males, because males vary in how much testosterone level they have. And men who have higher testosterone levels are more aggressive. Women, of course, have a certain degree of testosterone, and it varies. If you take just women, again, the women with the higher testosterone levels, they are more aggressive. And so this could be one of the biological factors that in part explains why men are more aggressive and violent. They have higher testosterone. Another factor like that, low resting heart rate. Men have lower resting heart rates compared to women.
Oh, is that right?
Absolutely. So, you know, that also is a candidate for explaining gender differences in crime.
Let me see what Joe from Morristown has to say. Joe, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Whoops, we will get Joe set up. Yes, go ahead, Joe. You're on the air. A little pregnant pause there. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I've been working on lead poisoning prevention since the early 90s, and as the doctor might know, one of the impacts of lead exposure is aggressive behavior. And some work done by Dr. Needleman in the mid-90s showed that kids with early childhood lead exposure were more likely to get in trouble with the law as they reached young adulthood. So this seems like a fascinating connection, his work, between that observation and possible anatomical changes due to lead exposure.
Joe, thanks for the call. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, you're quite right, Joe. Herb Needleman did that breakthrough research. And, you know, it goes beyond that. You know, there's now brain imaging work showing that lead, obviously, it's toxic to the brain, but it certainly damages that very prefrontal region of the brain that we find to be impaired in offenders. And the story gets more interesting because, you know, there was a big increase in violence, you know, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And there's an argument that it was the increase in lead 20 years previously which accounts for that increase. So let's take in the 1950s. There's a two-year-old kid. He's outside playing in the dirt. He puts his fingers in his mouth. He's absorbing the lead. 20 years later, in the 1970s, when violence peaks, when you're 20, he's accounting in part for the increase in violence. Then, you know, after the 1990s, violence began to come down. You know, it went up, then came down. And again, the reduction of lead in the environment can in part account for that. In fact, the changes of lead in the environment can account for 91% of the change in violence, you know, across those decades.
Joe, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And just picking up on that, you talk not only about lead, but you talk about cadmium, manganese, mercury. I mean, these are all heavy metals, I guess, that are very much a part of our environment.
Yes, and toxic to the brain.
And toxic to the brain as well. Let me see what Anita from Lansdale has to say. And Anita, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, Professor Brain. My question is that during World War II, there were so many women drinking and smoking at that time that they didn't know the dangers of which we know of today. And I wondered if there's been any research by yourself into the children that came from those pregnant women after that in violence and crime.
Well, that's interesting. Anita, are we talking about England here, or are we talking about worldwide?
Well, it could be both.
It could be both.
As I was brought up in England, England was mostly on my mind, yes.
Oh, fair enough. Your accent gave you away. Go ahead,
Yes, but the answer is no, not insofar as people following up people who were born in a certain period of time like that. But what has occurred in many studies now, I mean more than 10, in many countries in the world showing that, you know, over and above other social factors, if a mother smokes during pregnancy, she's more likely to have an offspring who is antisocial and violent. But you're making a good point. Mm-hmm. You know, there's lots of people who smoke during pregnancy that the children are quite normal. My mother smoked like a chimney. She smoked 20 cigarettes a day. And so, you know, again, I think an important message from The Anatomy of Violence is it's biosocial. There's a mix, a toxic mix of different factors. It's not just one thing. You need a perfect storm of different things coming together. And the maternal smoking or drinking is only, frankly, just a very small part of the equation.
Anita, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But reading your book, you know, I began to think that we could think of criminal behavior as a medical problem or a brain problem. Is that a helpful way to think about this?
I believe it's a helpful way to think about this because, you know, if you look back, you know, hundreds of years ago, you know, epilepsy, madness, well, the devil was inside them, you know, and we threw away the key on those people. But with advances in science, we've learned that there's in part a biological basis to, we've understood epilepsy, we've understood psychosis. It's not witchcraft. And what I would hope with the evolving biological knowledge on crime and violence is that we'll begin to recognize that, you know, that there's something broken, something wrong with these offenders, something biologically wrong, just like there's a biological basis to depression and anxiety disorders, and just like there's a social basis to depression. We have exactly the same thing, I believe, in recidivistic offenders. They are damaged goods, and they need to be fixed.
Well, and fixing is a whole other issue here, but here's a soundbite from your book. The seeds of sin are brain-based.
And they're sown early on in life. I do believe that, in large part, the foundations for crime and violence do come early on in life. And, you see, I think that there's a hopeful message here, because young children are malleable and far more plastic than when they're 15, 16, 17. If we could put more resources into enriching the environments of these, of young children who may be predisposed to a life of crime, wouldn't that benefit all of us in society?
But could you imagine someone going into court not using the Twinkie defense that was used out in California, but using the amygdala defense? I mean, essentially saying it was my amygdala that made me do it.
Well, I'm guilty of that sin. So I've been in court defending a murderer, a man who murdered and raped a wonderful young woman, and argued I brain scanned him. And I showed to the jury that the frontal cortex was clearly working much more poorly in him than other people. The emergency brakes weren't there on his behavior. And in his case, I mean, he was facing the death penalty, but the three-judge panel in Colorado bought the biosocial argument that a toxic mix of a horrible home environment, absolutely terrible, combined with a brain dysfunction, predisposed in large part this man to do what he did. So he is serving life rather than being executed.
But it does raise the question about responsibility. I mean, we are at least hopefully responsible for our behaviors, or of course there can be mitigating factors.
That's a concern. There's a concern. You see, if you buy into the argument that I've just suggested in that capital case, if you buy into the brain excuse, well, where does it end?
Sure.
You know, there's a cause of all behavior. And so just because we're finding the causes of behavior, albeit early causes beyond the individual's control, does that really mean to say that we should excuse them? There's a part of me that says, no, we shouldn't. We need responsibility in society, and we don't want to have more excuses because that could lead to Armageddon and a lawless society.
Let me get, looks like Gil from Bluebell, Pennsylvania, to join our conversation. Gil, go ahead. You're on the air.
Taking my call.
You're welcome.
My question is, are you aware of any research that's looking at the military experience? People who start out with no real evident proneness towards violence, yet are essentially trained to be violent in order to protect themselves and their colleagues, and then go through that experience and return home. Anything about any changes en route or any way to help return them to the state before they were so trained and experienced?
Fascinating question, Gil. Thanks for the call.
I haven't done the research, but certainly other researchers have done research on veterans, and showing that those who have been traumatized during the warfare, they have a structural impairment, damage to the hippocampus, a part of the brain that actually is involved in aggression regulation. So we certainly know that experiences like warfare, especially traumatic experiences, certainly change the brain and can change behavior. What I'd like to think is it's not just that negative experience can negatively impact the brain, but let's try and think of positive mm-hmm. experiences that we can do to enhance the brain to improve behavior.
Gil, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Does the brain, though, maintain its plasticity through life?
It's more plastic earlier on in life, but there's always some plasticity, and there's always, you know, a chance for change. So, like, even with these young offenders, giving them omega-3 fish oil, that can reduce their serious offending in prison by that 34%. So, you know, it's never too early to try and stop violence, but it's also never too late either.
I mean, that seems like such a simple experiment to run. I mean, just to give omega-3 to people in prison and see what happens.
And yet there's only two studies that have ever been done, one in England and one in the Netherlands. Both are showing a 35% reduction. And it's really calling out for more research.
And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499, talking with Adrian Rain about his book called The Anatomy of Violence. You begin this book with a really horrifying account of being in, you were in
Turkey,
in a hotel room and being violently attacked in your hotel room.
It was 3 o'clock in the morning. I couldn't sleep. It was very hot. And I was suddenly aware that somebody was standing right above my bed. Now, in criminology, I tell my students, you know, if a burglar comes in at night, just pretend to be asleep, because he usually just wants to get the stuff. What do? I, in one bound, leap out of bed and grab him by the throat. And he punches, kicks me, and I didn't know that when he's hitting me with a knife. And fortunately for me, the blade of the knife snapped off early on in our fight, so that when he stuck it in my throat to cut my throat, there was only 3 or 4 millimeters of metal left on the handle, so I only needed 6 stitches. I couldn't speak, and there was blood down my chest. And I began the book that way because I want people to know I know what it's like being victimized. And there's a bit of a Jekyll and Hyde inside of me. The Dr. Jekyll is saying, hey, early risk factors beyond someone's control, cut them a break. But, you know, there's also a Mr. Hyde inside of me that rants and raves and says, what about responsibility? What about justice? What about retribution? How about an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth? My throat was cut. Mm-hmm. I want his throat cut.
But also picking up on what you said earlier, which was that looking at your brain looks like that of psychopaths and murderers, whether your response was, you know, to fight back as opposed to sort of pretend you were asleep.
Yeah, sort of an automatic fight-flight reaction. And actually, that comes from the amygdala.
Right.
I think that just jump-started in me. So my conscious brain, the prefrontal cortex, was still sort of asleep. But when certain stimuli threaten your life, you act immediately. Right. And, you know, there's more no forethought there.
But do you think we all have some version of this Jekyll and Hyde? I mean, which is this desire for revenge, whether we like it or not, or some kind of retributive justice, feeling that sense of fear, wanting to defend oneself, but also not wanting to put one's life on the line?
I think many of us have that Jekyll inside, if we're honest, inside of ourselves. You know, for some people, it's more the Jekyll than the Hyde and vice versa. But, you know, these are not easy questions. I mean, for example, can you know, if you take a baby suffering from fetal alcohol syndrome whose mother drank, it's 19 times more likely to be convicted as an adult. Was that innocent little baby responsible for the fact that the mum drank? No. Will we hold that baby responsible? Yes. Is that justice? The Dr. Jekyll inside of me says, I don't think it is. But the Mr. Hyde says, you know, I don't care about the causes. Look what he did. If he murdered and raped someone, come on, you know, sentence him.
You talk about a number of things, at least to think about. I don't think you're recommending this. One is to think about, for instance, licensing parents.
Yes, that's right. I get into a scenario in the future. It's not that I'm endorsing that approach, but, you know, we know that bad parenting is not just deleterious for the child socially, but I think it can be negative for brain development too. So would we ever get to a level where we would restrict people being a parent? Now, I think that's a bridge too far, frankly, to go.
Right.
But let's spin it down a little bit more. Would we ever make parenting skills classes compulsory in high school? Because, frankly, you know, the most important thing many of us do in life is have children. It's the one thing we're taught nothing about at all in school. Can that help kids with emotion regulation, checking their impulsive behavior, and not just make them better parents, but also make them less antisocial?
You also raise a question about, I guess it would be preventive incarceration. The idea is you see someone's brain, you see that they're at high risk for some of this antisocial violent behavior, and this sounds like a science fiction movie, a very bad one. You know, the possibility of detaining them as a preventive measure.
Yeah, I mean, it's 2034. Not 1984, we're 50 years on. But the science has developed more. And what if we ever get to that level where we can predict far better than we can now who is going to be a violent, dangerous offender? Would we take the preemptive strike and lock them up and detain them in benign conditions in order to protect society? That sounds very science fiction, but, you know, the harsh reality, I mean, in England, my country, we have the Imprisonment for Public Protection Program. You know, that's a situation where a judge has to make a decision. Is somebody dangerous? And the judge can give them life in prison, even though normally the sentence would be a lot less than that, if the judge believes that they're dangerous. So judges are making that decision on very little information. Given that that's occurring now, what could happen in the future with better science?
Well, something to think about. Adrienne Raine, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. Thanks very much. The book is called The Anatomy of Violence, and it's subtitled The Biological Roots of Crime. And again, he's the Richard Perry University Professor in the Departments of Criminology, Psychiatry, and Psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.